Good morning, Trinidad and Tobago. Welcome. It is 13 minutes after 10 o'clock. Thank you so much for joining us on the 95 Mandate this morning. Opposite me, a very buoyant, bouncing, literally, Mariano. Good morning, Mariano.
Good morning, Hadeem.
Yeah. So, on that note,
Mariano, I think we should leave the shuffle behind. Let's just wait. It's an election year. We have lots of time. I think at this basis, elections are not going to come as quickly as we thought, because these changes have to take a little time to embed and settle in and so on.
Well, I certainly never thought they were coming sooner rather than later.
Well, I thought that they would have, precisely from the point of view of money, right? Because it is a budgetary difficulty. But I've always had in the back of my mind that they have $7.5 billion from the sale of Clico methanol, which they haven't really accounted for. And having said that... let's go to the main issue of today. We want to welcome Mr. Afra Raymond. Good morning, Mr. Raymond.
Good morning, colleagues. Good morning, listeners.
And thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things, we passed an anniversary last week, which would have been what? The
sixth.
Yes, this the sixth anniversary of what shall we call it? The debacle, the collapse,
the announcement of the fiasco.
Well, how fitting that Mariano should be here with you today to discuss this.
Absolutely.
Having been at the absolute start and, genesis of the whole thing, Mariano.
Well, I could tell you. I mean, it's the absolute start and genesis. Well, let's
watch the bailout.
Fair disclosure.
Of the bailout.
Fair disclosure. Let me disclose my relationship with the Clico Group before we go any further. I was an employee of Republic Bank for 9 years. And I also established Clico Investment Bank with some other parties on behalf of Clico when I had left Republic Bank and went to Clico. And I also worked at one of their group companies in Barbados, which is Caribbean Commercial Bank, for about 11 years. But I was never in the bowels of Clico for whatever reason. I was literally on the periphery and outside. So that... I have a view. I knew what was taking place. I know the players very well, but I was never involved in any of the... and clearly, I was never called as a witness, nor was my name ever mentioned at the commission quite happily, because I was not part of it. And I had left the group roughly 5 years, January 2004, January 4th, 2004, actually. Would have been 5 years, 1 month, 25 days to the day before all this happened. I would have been out of Clico. So, I mean, I know the players. And at the same token, when I came into government as Minister in the Ministry of Finance, I never had to deal or interface directly with them, but I was aware that things were taking place. And I could tell you that on the fateful day of the fateful week when all these things were taking place, I was, in fact, in Barbados, meeting with then Prime Minister David Thompson, who was chairman of a finance committee, which was part of COFAP, the Council of Finance Ministers, which is an agency or an institution within CARICOM. So I was literally far away from all the fireworks. But I did happen to participate in cabinet on a few matters when it did crop up. So I did have something of a ringside seat. And I have written and published in the newspaper on the matter. And I've also published at a conference in terms of how do you deal with problem institutions. I think I have problem financial institutions. I know a little bit about it because I participated in the establishment of Workers Bank 1989. The bank I dealt with in Barbados was, to all intents and purposes, a failure. Mm-hmm. I managed to rescue that. So I've developed a little reputation as a result of that. And I did one or two other things. So I have some, and I also wrote my thesis on the basis of failed financial institutions. So I had a little, I had a ringside seat, but no hands on the levers.
But like I said, how fitting that you would be here to carry on this conversation.
So I was just what you call, establishing where I stand. I was establishing where I stand.
Okay, so you're going to launch right
into it. Well, 6 years later, I know that in the time that I was in government, there was always the issue first of all, I would tell you that there were lots of differences of opinion, certainly how the actual announcement was managed, what actually took place. There wasn't, if you want, unanimity of positioning with respect to How it was going to be dealt with, how much money should be spent, where were we going to go. Cabinet at the time, there were differences of opinion, understanding that something needed to happen, but that we couldn't do very much with it. All right.
So, Afra, is it that you got wind of it before it happened, or did you become alerted to it at the announcement stage?
Well, I'm not going to pretend any inner knowledge. Unlike Mariano, I didn't have a ringside seat. And I'll come back to you with that question about being called to the commission, because I have a contrary point of view from yours.
Yes, right.
And contrary information. Well. But anyway, let's just deal with Ardeen's question. Mm-hmm. Ardeen, I need to say to you that my first indication that all was not well with that Clico group was in 04. We had policies with Clico. And by we, I mean the firm I work for, Raymond and Pear. We had all of our pension and all of our health plans with Clico. And certain things took place that made me realize that the dealings that we had had with them were not straightforward dealings, okay? And in fact, as a result of those meetings we had with our agents, when we realized that what we had been told about the policies weren't true, we cut our relationship with Clico since 04, okay? And we only maintained our health plan. But in terms of the investment type policies, the pensions, and so we cut our policies because I realized that they'd been telling me A, but what they had sold us was B. So the actual dealings and the substantial dealings of the company were in investments and pensions and that sort of thing. The substantial dealings of the company were not being conducted straightforward. So I'm not an accountant or a banker like Mariano that would have the kind of professional insight into that thing. And latterly, after the collapse was announced, and I'm going to be careful to say the collapse was announced, I became intrigued.
But are you satisfied there was a collapse?
I think it's a collapse took place before.
You think there was a collapse took place?
Before, yeah.
Well, how would you define a collapse?
How a company unable to meet its obligations.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, the classic definition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and in fact, I'm going to rely on that on two things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to rely in the first case on the group, and you mentioned it, although you weren't in the meeting, the group that you formed part of, which was the cabinet, taking the decision to do that bailout on the 30th of January 2009. And I'm going to rely on the terms of engagement for the Commission of Inquiry, Coleman Commission of Inquiry, in which the cabinet instructs the president that these four companies have collapsed and to appoint a commission and the so-and-so person to conduct an inquiry.
Well, that instruction is not the same cabinet.
I know, but I'm making the point that you were part of the first instruction, which gave rise to the second instruction.
All right, let me put it this way.
There's a concept called collective cabinet responsibility.
And I accept responsibility
Good.
For that, but I will tell you something
So
else.
We agree?
I know we don't, because Good. I was not at the cabinet meeting where that decision was taken.
Okay, are you telling me that if you were there, you would have voted against it?
Actually, yes.
Okay. That's interesting.
And I could tell you one other thing, because the whole methodology, and this is the instructive part, the difference
mm-hmm.
between how Barbados has approached it
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and how it has been approached.
Yeah.
What was approached in Trinidad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Barbados, in a sense, operated in a fashion to limit liability
mm-hmm, of the government.
And they appointed a judicial manager.
Deloitte, yeah.
Right?
I know, yeah.
In particular. Mm-hmm. I know a little bit about the circumstances of that. And that, for example, was where my head was at. In terms of wherever it had to be done, you had to basically, because you weren't aware and you weren't clear, right, of where you are. But once the decision been made, once the public decision been made, I mean, at that stage of the game, I mean, I could register my dissent, but I can't say that what you got to do. You know, I can't renege unless of course I resign altogether.
Yeah, yeah. But pointing. The point I'm making here is that our government took a decision to proceed in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
okay, and that decision is something that is for some of the reasons you've outlined and some other reasons I've done, that decision is questionable. One could say it's a decision that's questionable in substantial senses. First of all, we didn't know, which is the point you're making. We didn't know what the actual figures were.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the required degree of independence, what colloquially we'd call arm's length, between the judicial manager and the regulator wasn't observed. Because in fact, as it is in Trinidad and Tobago, the both roles are being conducted in the same chambers.
All right.
And that's another difficulty, apart from not knowing the figures.
And you mean the central bank
Correct.
In particular.
Correct, yeah.
Well, I will also have to say, and this is where I think that, for example, the governor of the central bank was very skillful, right? Because you see it as the two roles were joined. I thought the governor very skillfully managed to dump it in the lap of the Minister of Finance, who gratefully accepted responsibility. I thought that by itself was a hilarious position.
Because she signed the MOU.
Yes, not the governor. Right? And the reason why the governor limited his participation very, very skillfully from that perspective was technically he didn't have any money to cough up. So if the state wanted to take that position, mm-hmm. by all means, mm-hmm. but I'm not going there.
So what you're both saying is that best practice would have it that there be an independent third party.
Some separation.
Okay.
Yes, there needs to be an arm's length. You can't have the same thing happening in the same chambers. That's acceptable as a point, you know. Right.
And what also, mm-hmm. and the reason why you could see that ambivalence continues, mm-hmm. because it wasn't, I mean, during mm-hmm. the period in which I was in cabinet,
yes.
how much money was spent? Initially, the $9 billion went. Mm-hmm.
And it
went pretty quick, but Correct. It didn't all go in one. It went in kind of pieces.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, of that $9 billion, $5 billion went effectively to fill what was said to be the gap in the statutory fund.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So that the government at that stage of the game was also attempting to limit its involvement. And you could see that in terms of how much money was spent. Right? Hang on a second, you catch me here. Right? There's plenty more money than we were talking about. And that's why I would have used the role of a judicial manager.
Yes.
Right? Because judicial manager gave you sufficient space.
That arm's length.
And arm's length and gave you sufficient power.
Leverage.
Right?
To deal with the situation.
To get information. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right? And that is what I would have recommended.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Right?
Admittedly, the weakness in using a judicial manager is none of the companies that have ever been put in under judicial management have ever survived.
It's like surgery was successful, the patient died.
Wow, okay.
No, it's true. You're correct. It's like a final option, yeah.
It's what you call it. It's true. Because we haven't,
you're right.
In terms of managing what you call it, failures, we have had, our experience has been limited to park up on one side. For example, with the exception of Workers' Bank, mm-hmm. all the financial institutions in between 1981 mm-hmm. and 1990 were buried. Mm-hmm. All of them buried and they're gone.
Yeah.
Right? 1989 was a specific decision, and then that had to come with a whole other series of sub-decisions mm-hmm, mm-hmm. at some time in the future to enable it to survive.
Yeah.
And it had to be managed. FCB only came out of essentially under the curtails of the central bank in 2008, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we're talking how many years now? 1990
it's to 2018
yeah, to 20 years. Yeah, yeah. Now that is what most people don't get recovery up. This is not North America. We don't have the depth of the financial markets, so that the issue of getting what you call it, the issue of getting and dealing with what you call these matters is always difficult.
It's really difficult for Mariano to figure out how to turn off his phone or put it on silent. We have the same issue every week.
Now,
yes, boss.
Yeah. Now, the point is that we had the situation with the central bank managing the operation. You know, it was trying to manage the wounded company, or the companies, wounded companies. And there's some things that are really remarkable about it. For me, for example, To go back to a point where I think in some of your earlier remarks, Mariano, at the beginning of this interview, you seem to be indicating some correspondence with me, and another point we haven't taken up so far.
When you say correspondence, you mean agreement?
To a degree. To a degree. We have corresponded, but yeah. But the point I'm saying,
I want us to get it clear, because correspondence, you know, by definition could mean email.
Yes. I might have spoken inadvertently. It's possible. As a speaker, I could have been inadvertent. But seriously, the point is, you were making a point earlier on about the cabinet having to make a decision. Mm. And you weren't present, you were elsewhere in other meetings.
Deliberately too.
No. Just walk into what you're saying. I want to drill down to what you were saying.
Not deliberately on my part. Remember, I was given an assignment.
You were dispatched.
Get out of here.
Yeah, you were dispatched. This is how it goes sometimes, eh? And the thing is that you indicated that once the cabinet decision had been taken, which is where the discussion gets very, very fertile. Because my first point to you was that I think the company had collapsed. You responded by asking me, am I sure it collapsed? Why did I say it collapsed? And then a few minutes later, you went on to say, well, in fact, once the cabinet had taken the decision, more or less the die was cast mm-hmm. to proceed in a certain way.
And correct.
That's agreed. But what's interesting is that the case that has been made, and I'm not locating it with you particularly, but the case has been made broadly, is that in fact it was necessary to do what was done in the manner it was done, because the alternative was a collapse of our financial and economic
system.
Yes, that has
been the case.
That has been a widely discussed point of view. And in fact, I always ask, what are the alternatives?
All right, well,
is that really true that we would have had a collapse? And more to the point, and this is one of the points I take up as somebody, I don't want to call myself a Republican because that has all kinds of odd implications, but as somebody who recognizes the importance of the Republic and my status as a member of a Republic, I have an objection to the idea that this decision was taken, quotation marks, behind closed doors, quotation marks, in smoke-filled rooms, announced to the public on Friday the 30th of January 2009, and only brought to the Parliament on Wednesday the 4th of February 2009. And that Wednesday the 4th of February, and I hope we may not have time to go into it here, the number of things that occurred on that day, it was like an echo through our society on that particular day. The parliamentary session was just one of the things. But the point I'm making is that by the time Parliament got to discuss it, to go back to the point where you and I appear to agree, by the time Parliament got to discuss it on the Wednesday after, it was already a done deal. Mm. It had the signature of the Minister of Finance. It was witnessed. It had Lawrence Dupree's signature. It had been all over TV and radio. Mm. And in fact, really, what was Parliament there to discuss? Well, and I count it as an episode where the true role of Parliament, in my opinion, for what it's worth, I'm just put a commentator, was perverted. I call it a perversion of Parliament.
Let me respond to that. I mean, I ought not to be. I should be answering the
question. Yes, we have a discussion. We have a dialogue.
I should be asking the question.
Sure.
But let me respond to that. All right, let's take our cue, for example, either in Ireland,
true,
right, or in the US, mm-hmm, or in the UK. Right, in all instances, we've had financial crises. I'm only going to take the most immediate one.
Yes.
Right, in 2008. Right, in the case of, and we have, in the case of the US, they have about 3-4 different regulators.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the Office of Control of Currency, the Federal Reserve Board, the Treasury Secretary, mm-hmm, amongst others. And I can, there's a fourth one, the SEC Commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in every instance, the decision was made to prop up, in the first instance, AIG, an insurance company.
Yes.
Where, for example, where the Treasury gets Secretary get involved in that, right? EIG was an insurance company, mm-hmm, a regulator fells out of it. And the answer was that because it would have had untold damage on the financial system.
Yes.
Now, the reason why governments act and act quickly in this,
mm-hmm,
one,
mm-hmm,
if I had to defend my own,
yes,
is that you don't want to find out after you let one fail that the domino effect works all the way through.
Yep.
So what you do, and in the case of what you call it, the Treasury Secretary, they allowed one to fail.
Yes, Lehman.
Right, one to fail,
they
allow Lehman to go, mm-hmm, through, and then when they recognize what were the other possibilities,
they jump in
and they save Citibank, they, mm-hmm, save this one,
Bank of America,
everybody, AIG,
mm-hmm,
what you want, not for the first time, because this had also happened virtually 8 years before. This was Citibank had also failed 8 years before,
mm-hmm,
nobody was any the wiser. Because they ran it, and they ran it very quietly and very privately. So when it comes to decisions which go to what they consider to be the issue of financial and national security, those decisions are made, and they're made without reference. They come and tell you about it afterwards. Same thing in England, right, with regard to Royal Bank of Scotland, with regard to, Northern Rock, they let
Building Society, yeah.
Right, they let Northern Rock go through. But when it came to RBS, they felt that RBS was too big as part of the system. We came up with a plan.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things are done first, announced second, and we account for it after.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's urgent.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go into a talk shop and tell everybody, even for example, even the way that the Minister of Finance and the Governor handled the announcement was absolutely stupid. I say stupid. Maybe I should have used a more discreet phrase. You don't make an announcement like that.
Inadvisable.
All right, inadvisable. That's a wonderful word.
Lovely.
Thank you very much. You do not make an announcement at 12 o'clock in the day when other financial institutions are open. That is absolute and total madness. Right? But I in Barbados, I in a meeting, and I hearing all this people calling me on the phone. What am I going to say?
Well,
at that
we'll stage pause again? There. We'll pause there, and you will tell us when we come back after the 11 o'clock news update, and then a commercial break. So do stay with us. We have a lot more coming up.
Well, welcome back to, I won't say heated discussions. but clearly,
it's not for this place. but we have the air conditioner on.
But clearly, what you call it, some interesting positions which are being developed. It certainly is not the way we had planned for this.
Thank you for blindsiding us, well, no, Afra.
Not at all.
Yeah, he came with an agenda, clearly.
Not at all. Anytime.
All right. So that the issues that you talked about is that they lack transparency. That's yes. what you call it. And I was responding to the fact that I'm saying that governments in that type of positions are in difficult positions. And Trinidad is not unique in that regard. Yes. All right. So that is the way I would answer that.
Sure. But you see, there are two substantive issues coming out of that. I could understand the method that you proceed with an emergency situation that has to be negotiated swiftly and in relative silence. I can understand that. Having said that, two aspects of the thing irk me. So you have a group that is in that kind of a crisis. You challenged me earlier on as to whether there was a true collapse, and in my own belief...
No, I don't challenge you.
You asked me the question.
I asked the question, quite frankly... What the reasons for its failure have not been established.
I'll come into that. I think that before January of 2009, there were signs of something resembling a collapse. Okay, before that, but the company received, they had different measures to keep on functioning. Okay, and as a group of companies, it could do that. The two points I want to make is that firstly, we had a situation where an unprecedented loan, which is what it was, financial support, was being made in unprecedented quantities to a private company at no interest, which to me offends against fundamental sensibilities about what our treasury is supposed to represent. At this moment in time, Mariano, if you or I owe taxes, we have to pay 20% interest.
Yes, penalties.
So why is one of the wealthiest men in the Caribbean being advanced financial facilities at zero interest? Mm. So we need to get conscious about our financial and economic affairs.
Agreed.
So that's one point. Second point is that, in fact, you approach me as what in the banking and financial community we call a lender of last resort, which is what it fundamentally was. So you approach the central bank as a lender of last resort in desperation. And in fact, what we are seeing and hearing now, it appears that the company has kept its shirt, if you like, has kept its handle on its affairs. And it may even be, and I hope to develop this point later, it may even be that some of the key players there come back into control of the company and in fact have not in fact lost their company.
Well, I think if what you are saying is that what you call it, we've not had an accounting to the country for where the assets of the company are. What were the assets at the beginning? What are the assets now?
Yes, an accounting is lacking.
I accept that. The terms of the agreement are sufficiently loose. The memorandum of agreement, well, even the methodology, to intervene in the company required forbearance on the part of the shareholders.
True,
because as you well know, a memorandum of agreement, if really carried to court, is an agreement to agree and will fail for lack of specificity. Yeah. And the only reason that things have happened seems to have been some sort of understanding on the other side of the fence. Mm-hmm. But the point that I really was trying to get at, we know that under the PNM regime, under the PNM administration, $9 billion was spent. Mm-hmm. Right? We know that they came in and a new government came into position and said, look, the PNM didn't handle it well. But then we end up spending an additional 15.
Or more.
All right, or more.
It could be more,
Because we don't know, quite frankly. And by the way, this is money which has been borrowed, which now counts as part of our national debt.
Exactly.
All right? So that in those circumstances, I agree with you. But from my mind, the first instance has been lack of accountability. How much money actually went out?
To whom?
On what terms? How did the group get it? Mm-hmm. Where did it go into the group? Mm-hmm. How has the group been reconfigured? How is the group performing now? Mm-hmm. Where is the attempt at recovery? Because the fundamental issue with regard to the memorandum of agreement was that you were supposed to be able to recover monies.
Yes.
We know that methanol was sold and there was $7.8 billion recovered. I forget how much it was.
$1.174 billion. US.
Right? I understand that the Prime Minister said in Parliament that it had been used to buy Treasury bills, Treasury bonds.
Yes.
Quote unquote. Well, that means by definition, the funds would have ended up in the Accountant General's office. Mm-hmm. Is it part of my current year's income? Mm-hmm. Has it been used to repay debt? Is that the reason why the shortfall under our current financing arrangement is only $7.4 billion?
Yes.
Because I calculated that the real shortfall is closer to 15. Mm-hmm. right?
In terms of accrued deficits?
Not in terms of accrued deficits. In terms of the cash shortfall as a result of the changes in oil and gas prices.
Okay.
Right? And if you tell me it's only $7.4 billion, well, my argument is...
I find that surprisingly low. I found that figure low.
Right, so my argument is, well, tell me how all the numbers add up. The answer is, I don't know. And to my mind, right, what is the performance of the companies? We only have accounts are being presented only for one, Angostura.
I think Clico has accounts too.
But where are they? Have they been published?
I was reliably informed, wait for this, that some accounts are going to come out in the next 10 days.
10 days.
I'm reliably informed. I can't say anymore, but it'll be published.
They come out in the next 10 days for the last 6 years?
Over a period of years. You know, I know what you're saying. You know, I'm not defending them. I'm just saying what I was reliably informed. Uh-huh. I think it's totally unacceptable. As you know, I've actually litigated on that point because I think it's outrageous that we have a situation where the biggest expenditure the country has ever embarked on, arguably the biggest expenditure in the Caribbean, of public funds, is being conducted in what is fundamentally secrecy.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is incompatible. I can understand your argument for secrecy in the initial negotiations. Right. I'm not going to fight on that. But I'm saying that for all of this time to have passed, we had 6 years plus. For all of the center parts, we can't get a decent accounting. And what we have coming out, when the PNM was there, we had it for a bit. Now that the partnership is in power, we have it a lot more. They've been in power for 4.5 of the 6 years.
Five.
We have four and a half of the six years. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have statement after statement of this was 19, that was 22, this is 12.8. What are the figures? I mean, just to give an example, bouncing back with you, Mariano, in terms of the actual numbers. You have said, I think, two or three times in the morning, you've said that, in fact, PNM spent about $9 billion in terms of how it approached the thing in between the February of 2009 and the loss of the election in 2010 May. Now, when Prime Minister Prasad Biswasesa spoke to the Parliament on the 1st of October 2010, and she gave that fabulous speech where she basically said, this is wrong and we need to launch an inquiry into this and so on and so on. The figure she kept hammering on about, and Mr. Dukaran, when he spoke in the budget on the 8th of September 2010, the figure she kept hammering on about was $7.3 billion. She kept saying $7.3 billion has been spent. Is that a 7.3 or 7.2? Mm-hmm. You are now saying 9. So and I'm not saying this to be contrary, but at a very fundamental level, we lack an accounting. This is just emblematic of that.
And is this symptomatic of that relationship between the government handling or taking charge of this process,
mm-hmm.
and that being a problem in itself?
Well, I think I could account for the $1.9 billion difference. I suspect that as the money that is associated with Clico Investment Bank,
right,
and the depository support, which was done through FCB. Mm-hmm. So technically, the government may not have done it. It would have essentially ended up on the central bank's balance sheet. But if you put the two things together, that's $9 billion.
No, but the lack of transparency...
That's my accounting.
The absence of transparency on the whole that AFRA and others have mentioned, have highlighted consistently.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a symptom of this arrangement where the government is the one spearheading this particular...
Well, I don't know what the question means, but I could say this to you. Precisely because the government is spearheading it, it requires a greater degree of disclosure.
Absolutely.
Not the reverse.
Can I come in on this point? Absolutely. Let me just link something. I'm not here speaking with that hat, but I need to link something for the public and for the viewers, listeners. We have a concept that we call public money, which is treasury money, taxpayers' money. And the modern concept in terms of proactive and proper management in terms of public administration is that public money needs to be managed to a higher standard, accounted for to a higher standard than private money. So therefore, once again, I would agree with that point. Precisely because it was being handled through the Ministry of Finance and the Central Bank, there needs to be a degree of clarity. The huge sums involved, the number of entities. Last night, for example, I was looking at a witness statement by former director of CLF, CL Financial, Dr. Boendra Tiwari, who's currently a minister in the Ministry of Planning and Sustainable Development. And it was fascinating looking at that affidavit. I've had my difficulties and my differences with Tiwari over the years. But in fact, at paragraph 8, it is almost poignant because he's speaking about, and this is fascinating, and it's a question of how information cascades or doesn't cascade and how the lack of information can lead to a problem. He was a main board director for 15 years or more on CL Financial. And at paragraph 8, Tiwari says, as a director, we were given scanty information about what the company was doing. When we got a report let's say we have a call for a report on a particular company. We'd say, can we have a report on this? Most times somebody would come in and it would either be a very brief note just to answer a point, very narrow, or it was oral, an oral report. They would bring somebody in and the person would say, okay, this person will answer your questions, and the person would leave. We wouldn't have anything in writing. He said it was only when the company collapsed that I realized that there had been 283 companies in the group. I thought it was just 50 or 60. He said, I was astonished when I saw that in the papers, that he was on the main board. So the fact is that at the level of corporate governance, we were just speaking on a level of national governance and national public financial management. At a level of corporate governance, there's a situation where you have people who are in fact supposed to be directors of these companies, setting strategy and policy and controlling the operations of the company for management to implement the policies and the targets. And then you have those people being starved of information. And here we have in this discussion now, the public in Trinidad and Tobago, as a corollary of that, in the crisis, being starved of information, to even allow us to have an informed discourse on these questions. So there's a way that the things echo with each other.
Before you let Dr. Tiwari off the hook so easily.
Not at all.
And saying that the information was scanty, right? CL Financial published financial statements.
Yes, they did.
Which had clean audit reports from a company called Pricewaterhouse.
I remember that, yes.
All right.
Better you to say it than me, really.
Well, yeah. I'm saying it, but I mean, I was not a shareholder, so we could understand that too. So I never got the reports.
I know.
As a member of, as the CEO of a bank in Barbados,
yes,
where the primary shareholding was owned by the insurance company, mm-hmm, it was a point that the governor of the central bank used to complain with me about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not give the governor a copy of accounts because they were received late. They were received in arrears, and they were never relevant to the period that we were discussing.
Yes.
And he was always concerned.
This is CLF's account.
Okay. And always concerned over the potential risk exposure of the bank to such a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given I am the CEO, and I have to deal with a regulator, so by definition, the regulator can demand certain things of me, which I must perform. So imagine me now not being in a position to perform that. Mm-hmm. So I fully understand that point. But the point that I can't accept from Dr. Tiwari is that he did not read his financial statements. Because if he had read his financial statements under the disclosure requirements, he would have found out exactly how many companies, because it is required as a disclosure requirement. So I do not accept that statement from him.
Right? So Mariani, you just described the role that the central bank in Barbados would have taken, and I'm wondering, how does that compare with the role our central bank here took up in this issue?
You're getting a little more.
Well, that's a little bit more hot.
That's a little warm.
Bit more hot topic. Maybe after Raymond, you should ask that question.
Well, okay, let's talk about that. Let me just bounce back a second on the question of the responsibility of the directors, which Brown was making about Tiwari, and to make the point that indeed, another aspect of Tiwari's participation on the CLF board, and it was revealed at the Commission of Inquiry, was that in fact he was a member of the Audit Committee. So therefore, I would say that there was an additional responsibility. I don't know whether you would agree with me.
A bigger burden of care.
Aye. That's how you put it. I would say there's an additional level of responsibility that would accrue to that individual above and beyond a normal member of a board.
Agree.
So, let's come to the central bank role. The central bank role here is something that we need to disentangle very carefully, because there's been a kind of a urban legend that people have put around to make the point that Winston Dukoran was governor of the central bank when Ramesh and I think it was Trevor Sudama made particular statements about Clico and a report by the supervisor of insurance being technically insolvent in 1998 and 99 and so on and so on. And we need to kill that one dead. Not because we are supporters of Mr. Dukoran in particular. We don't support any living politician. We honor the dead. But we don't support any living ones, you know?
That's a little under the belt. Even this program does not allow under the belt blows.
I might have been inadvertent again. I'm sorry. But seriously, the point is that Mr. Dukoran was governor of the central bank in the period that we are discussing, which is 97 to 2002. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a fact.
Yes, agreed.
But the fact also is that the central bank did not have responsibility for insurance companies until 2004. Okay? Governor Ebert Williams was governor from 2002 to 2012, a 10-year period of office, 2 5-year terms. And it was during 2004, on or about the first half of 2004, that the central bank took responsibility for insurance companies. Prior to that, that responsibility was vested in an office called the Supervisor of Insurance, which is part of the Ministry of Finance. Okay? So just to make the point clear,
the timing not exactly correct there.
Go on.
But the transition would have taken place under Dukeran. That's when Catherine Kumar would have been brought in.
Under Williams? Not under Dukeran.
It had already started at that time, but it would have been completed under William.
That's right, yeah.
All right. But I can't remember who hired Catherine Kumar. All right. Hired her, which one came in at that time.
Yeah,
But I would say that a lot of the transitions had already been put into position in terms of the reporting and so on.
Now, I want to say something about the central bank's role in this now. We are trying to answer Mr. Ju's substantive question now. What was the role of the central bank here? Now, what was fascinating, two statements I'm going to pull from that are fascinating. There are many, many you want to pull from in a compact radio program. Let's pull two. If you go to Ewart Williams' formal prepared statement on the 30th of January 2009, at that fatal press conference,
Fatal?
Okay. It wasn't final, but it was fatal. It fatal press conference.
Fatal.
Mm-hmm.
Who did it kill?
Well, we come to that just now. Faithful is something else. It sounds almost like an act of devotion. But we want to stick with fatal. At that fatal press conference, Governor Williams says, and it's very interesting, he actually says, and I want to give two sharp references for listeners. He actually says that since 2004, he lists in the first page of the press conference five or six big things that symbolized how wrong the whole CL Financial thing was and why we had this crisis. Inter-party transactions, real estate thing, long-term investments made with short-term borrowings, and that kind of thing. He then says in the final paragraph of page one, well, since 2004, meaning since it came into my portfolio, the central bank has been grappling with all of these issues with this group. He then goes on to say, and the lack of political will and the lack of the correct regulatory, so on and so on, I tend to stymie our efforts to deal with this thing. And when I was questioned at the Coleman Commission, Anthony Coleman, 74 years old man that he looks, had read everything, had understood everything, and drilled right down into that passage in my testimony and said, Mr. Raymond, what do you think that means? That passage, what does that mean? I find that passage fascinating. That the governor of the central bank is telling the public on the 1st of January 2009 that for 5 years, I have known there was a major problem here. And different things have stymied me. And at the same time, this is the punchline, that governor has investments in the group. So it's impossible to reconcile a financial man, an economic man, at that level of a governor of the central bank, saying in a prepared written statement, I had serious problems with the way that group was operated. These are some of the problems we had. If we had the correct laws, we could have stopped them. And you had investments there? Come on. If you were somebody selling nuts in Woodford Square, or your retired aunt, but not the governor of the central bank, impossible to reconcile the formal position with his substantive behavior as an investor.
So you're complaining with his good sense?
Something like that. Lack of judgment.
Or lack of judgment.
Yes, and getting to the second point now, that's Mr. Governor Williams. Let's talk about Mr. Carl Hirelal. Mr. Hirelal sworn affidavit, 10th of April 2010. It was an affidavit to a petition, they call it, a winding up petition to the High Court with respect to CIB, which we spoke about a little bit earlier on.
Correct.
Paragraph 23 of that affidavit is fascinating. It's one for the ages, eh? Because in that paragraph, Mr. Hirelal is telling us that in fact, he's telling the court about the way that CIB has handled its taxation affairs. He is telling the court that in fact, the taxation affairs of CIB are in good order. Open brackets, except for the corporate tax returns for 2007, 2008, and 2009, which are now being compiled. Close brackets.
Well, in other words, they have not been finalized. The company is behind in meeting its requirements.
Absolutely. So you as a person, you are the regulator who could actually be in a position to call penalties in a company. How did you not know? Because Mr. Hirelal assumed office as Inspector of Financial Institutions on the 1st of January 2007. Let's get with the timeline. And you're swearing, as we say in Trinidad, cool so, with an affidavit on the 10th of April 2010 in the High Court right here in Knox Street that 2007, 2008, and 2009 tax returns weren't completed. But they're being done right now. You're telling the judge that. You understand me? I'm talking about, what's the word we used just now, which phrase? A lack of judgment.
Judgment.
And, right, that kind of phrase. That's what we're talking about. You want to know what the role of the central bank? I could be here for the week talking about
it. Well, on that particular one, the central bank is entitled to raise some issues. I mean, he doesn't have to make certain that the company does its tax return. In which case, my question would be, what was the position with respect to its payments of installments and so on?
Of taxes and
yes.
Absolutely. That's a good question.
Right, because the relevant operative is not the governor in such an instance, it's not the inspector of banks, it is the Commission of Inland Revenue. And so I don't necessarily hold your view on that. I understand the point that you're making, but I don't necessarily hold your view on that. Stick a pin on that one. To summarize, I really want to get us clear as to what you... I think the critical issue you have raised so far is the issue of disclosure.
Yes.
Right? Disclosure then... and subsequently
ongoing disclosure,
accountability,
yes,
with regard to how the monies have been funded, and most importantly whether we will get them back or not, because we've had statements from the Minister of Finance which indicated that the prospect of recovery was real, and we had a demonstrated example of recovery taking place.
Yes.
Right, how that recovery has been dealt with, whether it's been used to extinguish debt or going into current expenditure is another matter.
The state,
right, the then issue in terms of not only the question of how much money has been used to support the company, but the fundamental issue is whether the remaining entities are viable, and how are we going to treat those viable entities. I think that and by the way, what are the current custodial arrangements, and who are the beneficiaries under the current custodial arrangements? So would that be the critical part, quite apart from the things that were said in the Commission of Inquiry?
Those are the main things. I mean, the points you're making, Mariano, I have litigated to get that information. Because...
Including under the Freedom of Information.
I have done that, yeah. I have them in court right now. And the points I've asked for four pieces of information.
And you're not acting on anybody's behalf.
This
you're
is on my own interest.
On your own
and
interest.
And it's not for me to recover any money.
On the public sector interest.
Correct. It's public interest actions by a private citizen. I'm not doing it to get back my money or anything like that. Those are the other groups are suing to get back their money. Now, the four things I asked for. Number one, I asked for the audited accounts of CL Financial. If those are unavailable, I want whatever unaudited draft management accounts the minister is using. Because the minister has been, all the three ministers so far have been quoting figures. Where do they get those figures from? I want what they're drinking. Second point, there was a briefing to Parliament in September 2011 at which the independent senators were briefed by the then governor of the central bank, Ewart Williams, and the then minister of finance, Winston Dukoran, and a team, and some young people and big lawyers came from away and so. And the idea was to get their votes for those special bills that passed. There were two bills that passed in September 2011. I believe you participated in the debate.
No.
They want to get an additional $10.7 billion borrowed, and they want to cloak the central bank.
Neither.
And they want to cloak the central bank in immunity from any lawsuit.
Yes.
Those two bills.
No, I wasn't part of those bills.
Okay, my mistake. Now, I've asked for details of that briefing. What did those two high public officials tell our independent senators in the parliament to persuade the independent senators to all vote for it? I've been told the details of that briefing are exempt. Third thing I'm asking for. The money that has been paid out, however many billion it is, we don't know whether it's 18 billion or 24 or 26. We don't really know. We hear figures. That money that's been paid out, I want details of who that money went to, which is the same accountability question. And the last thing I asked was this. Under the terms of the CL Financial Shareholders Agreement, which was signed on the 12th of June 2009, CL Financial came under the control of the state. Because that shareholders agreement specifies that there will be a board of seven members, and four of whom shall be appointed by the government. The chairman shall be appointed by the government. That represents, in every meaningful use of the phrase, control. And if CL Financial is a state-controlled enterprise, why aren't they filing under the Integrity Act? I've abandoned that aspect under the Freedom of Information, and I've taken up that aspect with the Integrity Commission, who I have to say, thus far, to use the Prime Minister's precious phrase from Invaders Bay, thus far, they have been not answering me. It's been a little bit of a zigzag thing. That's how things go in Trinidad sometimes.
So the bottom line is you haven't required any, I've gotten any of the information
nothing,
you required.
Nothing.
So as far as you're concerned,
the first three items I'm in court, yeah.
None of the criteria that you would have set out to say, for example, public information, disclosure, accountability, right, and so on. None of those criteria are met. Well, I think at this stage of the game.
Well, before
you had another question.
Yeah. What about the new shareholders agreement that is meant to be signed and that has been postponed nine times?
Okay.
Previously.
Well, let's talk about that. The shareholders agreement that was signed on the 12th of June 2009 mm-hmm. was really a very unique document, because what it did, it went beyond the MOU of 30th of January 2009. The MOU of 30th of January 2009 contained a rudimentary framework that the liabilities of CL Financial would be paid by the state and certain assets would be up for disposal to supplement that and to cover those costs and so on. A very rudimentary and loose framework. The shareholders' agreement of 12th of June 2009 was a remarkable agreement, because for the first time, and I have to say it was conducted under a cloud of something that resembles a 6 for a 9. There was a formal statement coming out of the Ministry of Finance at the time that said, and it was signed by my good friend, I mean, I'm godfather to his son, Conrad Enel. The official signed these documents and so on. It came out, Karen was away at the time, and Enel signed it. And I think he signed the shareholders' agreement too. And it said, this formal statement from the Ministry said that this agreement is merely done to formalize the thing that was agreed in January, and to really set operationalize how the whole thing will happen. I applied for that agreement under the Freedom of Information Act, and it took about a year and a half to get it. Eventually, Alison Lewis sent it for me under the FOI. Now, when you delve into the terms, one of the shocking terms in the shareholders' agreement is that, in fact, it now protects the rights of shareholders, which is the original offense I spoke about. Mm-hmm. How did shareholders, whose company has been effectively destroyed, to be in a position of having to approach a lender of last resort. Mm-hmm. How could shareholders get rights in that kind of scenario? And what was the negotiation stance in this?
Well, the answer to that is the shareholders never lost their rights. And that has to do with the original agreement. But mm-hmm. I mean, we could speak to that mm-hmm, issue. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I just want to, and that is one of the reasons why I guess you could say that the whole imbroglio leaves a whole, if not a bitter taste, a taste which says, look, we need to understand mm-hmm. exactly how we arrived at this particular mm-hmm. position and explain a couple things to us.
But is there another agreement that is supposed
well,
to...
Well, yes, let me answer you, Adi.
That's the other agreement.
You did ask me and I didn't get to you with precision. I apologize.
That's all right.
So the first agreement was remarkable for the reasons I just gave. Mm-hmm. And there have been a succession of agreements. There probably is now 8 or 9 agreements rolling forward. And to be quite frank, I have not kept up with all the different agreements. I suppose I could apply under the Freedom of Information and get all of them and compare them to each other. I have not done that. Because we've been told over and over that, in fact, they're just an extension of the previous agreement. That's what we were told. I don't know what is different about this situation. I'm not aware enough of the situation because of the opaqueness of the whole scenario. What is different about this one? Well, you're right, it's dragging, and I don't know what the reason
but
is.
But it goes back to what you're point mm-hmm. I made at the beginning. Mm-hmm. A memorandum of understanding mm-hmm. is not an agreement.
Yes.
It's an agreement to agree.
Yeah.
It will fail in court. Mm-hmm. And I suspect having started actions under, if you want, such loose type of arrangements, and you got, after you had spent your money and you found yourself in a difficult position, well, guess what? You now have to negotiate. Mm-hmm. Or alternatively, you have to come to Parliament for appropriation. Mm-hmm. When I say appropriation,
for
the power to take control of a private company. And that offends Section 4 of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I suspect in those circumstances, there were some hard negotiations behind the scenes, which meant that I had to recognize some residual rights. But that in itself is a subject of different type of debates mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that took place, if you want, at behind closed doors.
Yes, smoke-filled rooms.
Right? In smoke-filled rooms, in which, for example, I may have had a part in that, but that's another story. But I think at this stage of the game,
we are going to go to a break.
which
will take us into our calls.
I will let people call.
Yes, of course.
I have one more thing I want to say before. Sure. Can I talk a little
of
bit before the break?
Go ahead.
Mariana, I wanted to just put on the table that issue that we raised earlier. You were making a point earlier that you had not been called in the inquiry because of your remoteness from the actual operation
Correct.
Of the thing. And in fact, you were called in the inquiry.
No, no.
As
Nope.
Hold on.
I was called to the Hindu Credit Union inquiry. Hold on. I was never called to the, what you call it, to the CLICO inquiry.
The point is, they are, yes, in fact, it says a Hindu Credit Union, but in fact, on that inquiry, which is part of the same commission inquiry, according to Mr. Coleman, you have not offered to come and give evidence.
That's correct.
It was you, Conrad Enel, and Danny Montana.
I'm correct, yes.
And I am saying that if we are running a civilization, and if we are trying to do better, I'm just putting a point out there, and in fact we convene a lawful inquiry to examine an issue of great public concern, I think the responsible thing for all of the officials involved, even those ones who are ex-officials,
and I could answer, would have been to
come and offer your evidence.
And I could answer
and that was a disappointing part of all of this.
I'm
just
sure.
To place it frankly on the table. So in fact you were called.
I was called not for CLICO.
Yes, HCU, yes.
I was called for HCU.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell you this, the relevant person who had all the information, who could have said exactly what took place, was the Minister of Finance.
Yes.
Because in that particular matter,
Karen.
I had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
She mentioned my name in passing,
yes,
as a way of limiting her disclosure.
Exposure. But
and when I evaluated in those circumstances, what would I have added to the debate? And the answer was, when I looked at my role, the answer was, I added nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But we could have then ended up in an imbroglio. Just like the Prime Minister, instead of dealing with Anna and Rob Logan, she's dealing with David West. I decided in those circumstances, it was better to allow the record to stand as is.
Could you receive legal advice to that end, Mariano?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Let me just say two quick things in response to you. First of all, because you're asking me, what could you have contributed to the picture? And I would put it this way.
I could say to you now.
Mm-hmm, go on.
I have an affidavit. The affidavit is available. If you want to see it, I could let it.
I'd love to see
it.
You made it for me. You made it. I won't publish it. But hear what.
It is the hands of my attorneys.
Hear what I would have wanted to have heard from Brown on in the Coleman inquiry. One of the burning questions in all of this, whether it is off, whether it's the Piako Airport, whether it's Coleman, whichever commission of inquiry, is the hidden hand or the not-so-clear hand of the political financier. And one of the issues coming out of all of this was the fact that CL Financial was a large-scale financier of PNM. I don't know whether they were the largest. They made contributions.
Right.
And the point I'm making is that you put someone who had been a treasurer of PNM, like Mr. Montai, who didn't testify, or like Mr. Brown, who didn't testify in the witness stand, you could have elicited from them, asked them the question, as to the role of the financier in all of this confusion.
Well, I can answer that immediately. I would have known nothing about it because I wasn't party to anything. I could say that on air. I could say that before any commission of inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
My limited circumstances in Hindu Credit Union would only to have been spoken to this.
Mm-hmm.
When did Mr. Hari Narayan come into the ministry?
Yes.
Who introduced him?
Yes, yes.
And
yes.
What do you remember of it? That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing
okay.
else.
Okay. The point.
I know nothing about hidden hands of financiers there.
Not in that particular one.
And I could tell you, during my period of time as treasurer, right, CLICO certainly would have not put any money in anything that I would have been involved.
Well, no, we understand. We're not going down that road. We understand that. Now, the last point I want to make, Adi, in relation to the CL Financial, HCU, and Karen Nunes Teixeira.
The people are not going to be able to ask any questions, you know, because you ain't giving them
point
time to ask a question.
Is that people may not be aware, but HCU actually financed Karen Nunes Teixeira's campaign. They were one of the financiers for a campaign in Dabadi, Omera, in 07. Okay? That was in the Commission of Inquiry. And in fact, that was confirmed in the Commission of Inquiry. So there was a link, if you like, of the hidden hands of the financier. I'll take my break.
Thank you, Afro.
Sorry.
We are going to go to that break and then come right back with your calls
so far, so
and your text messages. 13 minutes before noon on 12 o'clock newscast, we go to the line 6223937 for those of you who wish to contribute. Remember, we don't have much time, so we ask that you limit your contributions. Good morning, welcome.
Hello, good morning, Adine. Well, you know, most callers don't like that line that you just used there. Anyway, Mr. Brown and to the gentleman there, the goodly panel, good day. You know, you all got to the topic that I wanted to get to last, which I wanted you to get to at first. The comparison between before this government came into power, you were not hearing the CLICO investors. As a matter of fact, they were totally silent. What policies brought about that difference into the reeling and the wheeling and the national T20 people partnership came into power? what policies were so different when the previous government was in power in comparison to this government. Have a good day, ma'am.
Thank you, Cole. Let's take a couple more calls. You're good to perhaps take some notes. Good morning. Welcome.
Hello, Adin.
Hi, Joe. Good morning.
Hi. Mariano?
Yes.
Afro?
Joseph, morning.
Morning. I was on notice about what CL Financial is capable of since March Securities took over the Trinidad Cooperative Bank. Then subsequently, when it bought a shareholding in Republic Bank and exceeded the limit that was established in law at the time, and the Republic Bank directors were apparently forced to negotiate with them some compromise where there was they didn't exercise that majority that they tacitly have by CL Financial directors owning large blocks of Republic Bank share and acting in concert with CL Financial to exercise effective control of a Republic Bank. And then there was also the question of the amount of interest being offered in recent years. That, to my mind, was a telltale sign. Then they had an auditor, if you remember, who decided that they would give back the brief, and I think they were collecting $13 million in audit fees. And they decided that they wouldn't have any of it. They preferred others. So if you went despite that and put your money in CL Financial, you simply didn't inform yourself of the situation. And I don't think that our situation in any way should be compared to America bailing out some of the entities in other parts of the world, because the magnitude in our case, the impact of bailing out CL Financial compared to the size of our GDP was much more significant. And the thing about it is the way they influenced, they exercised political influence, no matter which party was in power.
All right.
You know, and so you had all of the telltale signs, but importantly, Adil, just allow me.
Sure.
We made a serious mistake by not allowing CL Financial to go through, because that voided the natural cycles. The labor shortage we have today, the increase in property prices has been exponential. We could have afforded it, as the present circumstances show, and we could have managed it. We should have allowed CL Financial to go through. We would have had a much better economy today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's take another contribution, this time from Mr. Pumel. Good morning. Welcome.
Yes, hi, good morning, Ardeen. Good morning, Mariano. Good morning, Afro.
Hello, Peter.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I want to commend I-95 and you and Ardeen in particular for facilitating this type of discourse on this CLICO CL Financial issue. I also want to commend Afro for his efforts. I know he's been toiling very long and hard in the vineyard to get the information in terms of the accounting and so on. Mm-hmm. And I want to say, as chairman of the CLICO Policyholders Group, we fully endorse his efforts. And we are also looking forward to getting that type of information, because we believe it is critical to really understanding what transpired in the CLICO CL Financial issue. And the matter is, as you know, far from over, because there's still quite a number of assets that have to be disposed of. And it is very important for not only the policyholders, but the taxpayers to understand exactly how these assets are being disposed of, what are the proceeds from these assets, and what is being done with those proceeds. I don't want to keep you all very long. I know you have a lot of callers calling, but I just thought I would add my two cents to the discussion. But very good discussion, and I'll continue to be listening.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you very
You're
much.
Welcome.
Y'all wish to respond to the first two questions or comments?
Well, I think it's only one question so far.
Yes, one question.
The first question.
Right. The first fellow was asking about the shift in government policy, and we have to recognize what it was. Eh? There was indeed a shift, or I should say an attempted shift. And that attempted shift was noted on the 8th of September 2010 when Mr. Tukaran gave his budget speech, his first budget speech. And I would say what Tukaran attempted to do, to use a driving metaphor, he attempted to change gears. He attempted to introduce some sorts of measures or some sort of a program to slow down the rate at which money was leaving the Treasury to finance this bailout type arrangement. And of course, as we know, history shows, and the gentleman, the caller, made the point, we had a number of groups spring up. And Peter Pumel is one of the people who are representing one of those groups. He called a minute ago, Mr. Pumel, and a number of groups sprang up to represent the interests of depositors and policyholders. They started off, in fact, it's interesting, eh? A name is a hell of a thing, eh? What's in a name? They started off as policyholders and depositors groups. And when it became clear that the depositor was the wrong type of creature. Everybody became a policyholder. Is that the old joke from the Eastern Bloc? We're all comrades now. They all became policyholders. Nobody was a depositor anymore. But if you go back to the early readings, they were depositors and policyholders. But this is a little joke, Peter. It's all part of the season. We're in a silly season. There's a little bit of a bacchanal season, and I had to say it. But coming to the point, Mr. Ducaran attempted on the 8th of September 2010 to change gears and to slow down the rate at which money was leaving the Treasury. And what happened was almost unprecedented. We had an uprising among the middle class, an uprising among the upper middle class, an uprising among the comfortable class, openly so. Not the usual thing behind closed doors and so on, but openly so. They hired powerful attorneys and they hired rental halls and they had meetings and a whole campaign that out on the media and so on. And of course, the Prime Minister gave that famous speech on the 1st of October 2010, where she did two things. She initiated a sort of a ministerial committee from which Mr. Ducaran was excluded. It had Basan Barat and Mr. Gopi Singh and Dr. Gopi Singh and some people like that were in there to examine the competing claims, as she put it. And the second thing she did, the Prime Minister did, the Honorable Prime Minister, was to announce the commencement of a commission of inquiry into HCU and the CL Financial, which I thoroughly applauded. I had reason later on to be disappointed, because despite the loud protestations and the eloquent argument, it was a very high-level, silky argument. Despite all of that, we had a situation where, in fact, the whole argument about where did the money go ended up being excluded from the terms of reference for the Commission of Inquiry. Okay, so yet another case where I feel Parliament was deceived. So really, to answer the caller, that shift...
Well, Parliament doesn't deceive, the country was.
Exactly. That shift was exactly what it was that gave rise to all these groups that protested. And as we know now, although the government is still locked in different types of litigation, as we know now, it seems to me that more or less the policyholders have the state on the run in terms of some of the litigation has been going their way. I know that Mr. Maraj and his team, which is another team from Birmingham, they are going to go to London pretty soon, the Privy Council. They have a big case going up there, and they continue to fight the case and so on. But the important point, the second caller made, that's the first caller, the second caller, the one before Permel, one of the important points he made was proportionality. That's Joe Berman McDowell.
Mm-hmm.
And the proportionality point is really critical to get in terms of us getting a greater level of financial and economic literacy about our country. We have to know what is happening in our country. When America did the bailout, when we talk about Wall Street, the big one we see on TV every night, is some story with Obama and Timothy Geithner. And so Geithner was asked in December of, I think it was 2011,
mm-hmm.
by the Congress, how much does a bailout cost the country, the American, how much does it cost the government? And the answer was 1% of GDP. A little more than 1%, a little less than 1%, about 1%. In our case, Ducaran's estimate was 10% of GDP, and the IMF's estimate for our country, this small, was 13% of GDP. Well, so it's a colossal amount of money for a country of this size.
It's a colossal amount of money, but that also has to be... mm-hmm. When you look at DiCaprio, who is writing, for example, is the World Bank, in a sense, was the World Bank specialist. He now teaches at a university.
Who is that, sorry?
DiCaprio.
Yes, yes, yes.
All right, on this particular matter. Mm-hmm. The argument is that financial bailouts invariably cost anywhere between 5 to 10% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
When Mr. Geithner gave the answer about 1%, he was not exactly being fulsome with in terms of the analysis. Let's put it that way. So I do accept that argument. And the issue with proportionality...
He kept it low. He lowballed them.
Yeah, he lowballed them. Right, with the issue of... So he could get appointed.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue of proportionality with you, and the point that had been made from mm-hmm. the word go,
yeah.
was the importance of CLICO in the sense of, well, we had an international financial crisis. We just had a drop in prices. We were already going to go into a recession, but you're going to go into a recession where you have a large loss of assets, something in the region about 25% of GDP. Right? That was the estimate.
Yes.
And that's the reason why the state acted there. As to whether the economy would have been better, how we manage failures and so on, that's a matter of judgment. The real issue is, having spent $24 billion, which effectively will be the largest expenditure undertaken by the government of Trinidad and Tobago
ever.
On any transaction.
Absolutely.
On any transaction of any kind, in any one particular item. Right, that is really what requires. Have we dealt with it in the fashion we should have? The second largest expenditure with regard to any one particular transaction is the highway.
And at 7.
At 7.
So you can tell any kind of thing we're talking about.
That's the difference. Yeah. It's 3 times the size of the highway.
Yeah.
So it's not, this amount of money is not small. We're talking about a substantial portion about the potential development of the country that is tied up in a private entity. And that is what requires, that, if anything at all, is what requires, demands accountability.
And I'm fighting it in court.
And the information we put in the public domain.
Okay, let me just say something to you.
I think you have to wrap up now, Afra. I'm sorry, because we have 2 minutes left.
Let me just say quickly, I just got a text message from somebody on my Facebook, this, the man with no name. He says, Clico is publishing its 2013 accounts. No, hold on. He said to me,
it's being released in 2 weeks.
Accounts for 2009 to 2012 are online on the website for Clico now. It just went up. He's somebody
who looks at it.
Yes, he
the
just
accounts for 2013 is being released in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, he just sent that text here as well.
The person with no name.
Yes.
Don't call his name.
Yeah. No. We don't get names here, thankfully.
Good. Don't embarrass him. So I want to thank 95.5 for the support. Mariano, it's been good doing the interview with you. I was looking forward to this. I'm sorry I couldn't do it before Christmas. We have a serious situation in terms of accountability, transparency, and good governance with this issue. It is the largest expenditure in the history of our country, the largest expenditure in the history of the Caribbean. People remember, silence is the enemy of progress. I am continuing to campaign for this information in the public interest, and I thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marianne. I'm really sorry to all our callers who are still trying to get in at this time and all of the text messages that came through that we were able to address. Maybe we can have a follow-up sometime after.
Talk about this 2 weeks. We only touch a couple points, you know.
And we know that there are other issues that you're championing and have been at the fore of as well.
Touch a couple things lightly.
Yeah, so this may not be the last time, your last time on our program. Yeah, thank you so much.
Nice.
All right, so have a good one, folks. Mariano, enjoy Fiesta
raising,
tomorrow.
And I'm not sorry that we're raising all these serious issues. These have to be raised, whether it's carnival or not.
Yeah, I just hope it's done, you know, with some level of craft and skill.
What?
The calypsos. But anyway, that's another discussion. We go on.
Calypsos, come in. Okay, right.